Hello and welcome to Science World. This past Wednesday, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's newest space weather satellite, Discover, the Deep Space Climate Observatory, was sent into space from Cape Canaveral, Florida. Jessica Berman tells us about a new smart insulin that automatically regulates the amount of blood sugar in patients with type 1 diabetes. And we'll learn about a proposed mission to deploy a swarm of mini-cube satellites to study Jupiter's atmosphere. The scientists behind this plan believe that they'll receive more thorough and diverse data with a bunch of tiny probes versus one large spacecraft. We'll have these stories and more on today's edition of VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. A new satellite is on a 1.5 million kilometer, 110-day journey toward the sun. Once it reaches its orbit, Discover, the Deep Space Climate Observatory, will replace an aging craft to monitor space weather. Roseanne Skirbel reports.
And liftoff.
Discover is headed to a place in deep space where the gravitational pull of the sun and of Earth cancel each other out. That makes it an ideal spot for the craft to monitor the sun. From this faraway outpost, it will document the continuous stream of charged solar particles. Thomas Berger is director of the NOAA Space Weather Prediction Center in Boulder, Colorado. He says while we are mostly protected by the Earth's magnetic field and atmosphere, large-scale eruptions from the sun called coronal mass ejections can still be dangerous.
So those are really, really large magnetic clouds that are expelled from the sun at very, very high speeds. And when those impact the Earth, that's like a tsunami, if you will, or a hurricane impacting the Earth in terms of space weather.
Violent space weather can disable electric power grids, knock out satellites, interrupt radio signals and aviation communication systems, services we depend on in our daily lives. Full recovery from a really bad solar storm could take 4 to 10 years and cost between $1 and $2 trillion, according to a recent scientific report.
It's really not much we can do about it, given that the sun is a gigantic star and we're just a tiny little planet in its orbit. However, NOAA's job, and the Space Weather Prediction Center's job in particular, is to predict these phenomena and give people the watches, warnings, and alerts that they need to take mitigational action.
Discover will sit like a buoy in space. It replaces ACE, the 17-year-old craft that has worked long beyond its design life. Berger says Discover will ensure there's no gap in real-time solar observations.
That gives us between 15 to 60 minutes to warn people on Earth that a very strong storm, for instance, if we measure it at the Discover satellite, is coming into the Earth. 15 to 60 minutes is enough time for power grid operators to take mitigational actions, such as spooling up other generators to balance loads. It's enough time for satellite operators to take their satellites into safe mode if necessary. So it's enough time. We'd like more, of course.
Plans are underway for more instruments to provide that earlier warning.
It would be great if we had something even farther towards the sun. And that's possible using perhaps solar sail technologies in the future. But right now, what we can do is put something in that gravitational sweet spot, if you will, and leave it there. And that's the Discover satellite.
Discover, like ACE, will issue planetary-scale predictions and warnings. NOAA plans to use ACE data, too, as long as the aging satellite survives.
We can tell you something's coming in. However, with the ACE data in the future and developments in models that are very exciting, the upcoming models we're developing, we'll be able to tell you exactly which regions of the Earth will be more or less susceptible to these incoming solar storms.
This will mean, for the first time, warnings will advise not only that a magnetic storm is heading towards Earth, but where it will strike. Discover also carries two NASA Earth-observing instruments that will gather a range of measurements for other science work. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
This past Tuesday, the White House announced the creation of a new federal agency to analyze threats to the nation's cybersecurity and coordinate strategy to combat them. Science World's Doug Bernard has the story.
The Obama administration is launching the Cyber Threat Intelligence Integration Center as a central place to coordinate cyber threat intelligence coming from the FBI, the National Security Agency, the Department of Homeland Security, and other federal agencies. The center will operate under the guidance of the Director of National Intelligence. Currently, no single government agency is responsible for coordinating cyber threat assessments, sharing information rapidly among existing agencies, or providing timely intelligence to policymakers, said Lisa Monaco, assistant to the President for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism. The announcement comes in the wake of high-profile hacking attacks against Sony Pictures Entertainment, Anthem Health Insurance, Target, Home Depot, eBay, and J.P. Morgan Chase. The federal government has also suffered cyber attacks, including the hacking of unclassified computers at the White House and State Department, and the hacking of the Twitter and YouTube accounts of the U.S. Central Military Command. Several of the attacks have been blamed on hackers in Russia, China, and North Korea. For Science World, I'm Doug Bernard.
Researchers have developed a smart insulin that automatically regulates the amount of blood sugar in people with type 1 diabetes. Jessica Berman reports.
Type 1 diabetes occurs when the body's immune system attacks and destroys its own insulin-producing pancreatic cells. Insulin is a hormone that helps metabolize glucose from food, which cells use for fuel. People with type 1 diabetes must frequently check their glucose levels and inject themselves with insulin, sometimes many times a day, but the routine is imprecise. Too little insulin causes a rise in blood sugar that, over time, can lead to serious complications, including heart disease, kidney failure, and blindness. But if type 1 diabetics accidentally take too much insulin, they risk falling into a dangerous coma.
The idea, I think, the kind of the pie in the sky vision, so to speak, would be to have something that's completely autonomous. So if a patient didn't have to check their blood glucose level, if they could take a shot in the morning and know that they're covered for the day, that would be the best case scenario. I don't think what we have now is there yet, but I think that's where the generation of a truly smart glucose responsive insulin would go.
Matthew Weber is a biomedical engineer at Massachusetts Institute of Technology who helped develop a smart insulin that self-activates when blood sugar levels rise. A single injection of the long-acting agent binds to glucose molecules circulating in the blood, automatically bringing blood sugar levels down when they soar. Weber says researchers conducted tests using laboratory animals.
We can inject it into the mice, and when we simulate a meal 3 hours following insulin administration, blood glucose level in our treated group goes up and comes right back down the way you would expect after a meal in a healthy animal. And if we give the animals regular insulin, the kind of stuff that a diabetic patient might take, the blood glucose level goes up and stays up. So it has a longer lasting effect, and it also has a very rapid reversal of blood glucose.
The test shows that the smart insulin worked for at least 14 hours, repeatedly and automatically lowering blood sugar levels in the mice. The work was published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Researchers are hoping next to conduct human clinical trials of what would be the first glucose response insulin. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, we'll hear about plans for a future mission that would involve sending about 60 mini-cube satellites into Jupiter's atmosphere. For today's Science World Quick Quiz, from the following, what is the name of the first spacecraft to ever reach Jupiter? Is it A, Pioneer 10, B, Voyager 1, or C, Cassini? Think about it and good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
Showering typically sends water down the drain, but a new space-age shower could change that. George Putich, in this report by Marveline Danden, tells us more.
Get the wash towel wet.
Astronauts have no choice but to recycle the water they use in space. Now the Orbsis shower of the future brings that concept down to Earth. This futuristic shower comes from Orbital Systems, a Swedish advanced technology company. Its CEO, Mehrdad Majoubi, invented the product.
The shower of the future is a water recycling shower, thus enabling water savings over up to 90%, energy savings over up to 80%, but at the same time increasing comfort and hygiene. Water is being collected in the drain, is being analyzed, purified, and then pumped back up to the showerhead. So what's so special about the purification technology? Well, it's based on our patented purification capsule system that makes sure that water is always crystal clear.
Majoubi was inspired by a project between NASA and Sweden's Lund University to come up with designs for a mission to Mars. He adapted the closed-loop system that allows astronauts to reuse shower water again and again. The product already has been tested in Sweden, where it saved up to 100,000 liters of water over 4 months. Based on those results, Majoubi is confident his company can distribute the shower system worldwide.
Our market is anybody who takes a shower, actually. And the biggest benefit it gives to the market segments where the water consumption is the highest, such as bathing establishments, gyms, sports centers, also private households where the water consumption and the water prices are high.
The Out of This World design has won several business and innovation awards. For writer Marvelin Dandin, I am George Puttich.
So, you think you know your dog? But can your dog tell by simply looking at you whether you have a happy or an angry expression on your face? Researchers have taught pet dogs to know the difference. Science World's Bob Doty tells us more in this report by Jessica Berman.
Dogs are very attuned to sound. When they yell or speak harshly, many owners claim their dogs act guilty and slink away. But researchers in Austria have discovered that dogs can look at our faces and tell the difference between a smile and a scowl. In a series of experiments, researchers at the University of Veterinary Medicine, Vienna, taught dogs to recognize facial expressions by training them with two pictures of either the upper or lower half of a person's face, one happy, the other angry. Then the canines were shown images of the eyes or mouths of people they had never seen before, as well as the left half of the faces used in training. Corson Muller led the study.
We were essentially asking, do they realize that smiling eyes have the same meaning as a smiling mouth, or angry eyes have the same meaning as an angry mouth? And it turned out that they really did perform very well in these probe trials, so they had... Once they had learned the initial discrimination, they could spontaneously, immediately choose the correct one also in the probe trials with the novel stimuli.
In other words, once the dogs learned to recognize which image was happy or angry, they could easily identify the same expressions in pictures of any faces. Muller says future work will try to determine whether dogs can learn the meaning of certain expressions. For example, whether a scowl indicates a person is angry.
But what we cannot be sure of at this point is what exact meaning they are associating with these different expressions.
In the training trials, researchers found the dogs were slower to associate a reward with recognition of the angry face, suggesting they had an idea people with angry faces were best avoided. Muller says canine investigators are also interested in finding out whether wild wolves can be trained to recognize human facial expressions. The findings, published in the journal Current Biology, provide the first solid evidence that we are not the only species that can read another species' body language. For Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
Roseanne Skirbel returns to tell us about a laboratory experiment with tiny, almost microscopic worms designed to help us better understand the impact long-term space travel will have on future astronauts.
The millimeter-long worm is called C. elegans. The transparent invertebrate is often used in biomedical studies because of its short 2-week lifespan. Also, 70% of its DNA is the same as our own. At the University of Delaware, associate scientist Chandram Sabanaigam built a microgravity simulator to test how C. elegans would perform in the actual zero gravity of space.
Imagine if you have a container of water and you put an object in it and it begins to settle to the bottom. But before it hits the bottom, you flip the container upside down, and now it has to fall back down to the bottom. Before it reaches it, you flip it again. Essentially, this instrument rotates, and the object never hits the bottom. So essentially, it's in free fall, similar to a satellite orbiting the Earth.
As the worms are spun in free fall, the scientists watch on a monitor images of the creatures as seen under a microscope.
After about a week of rotation, in that environment, we'll take the animals out, and what you see us doing with the test tubes is basically biochemical preparation to analyze its genetic material.
They're looking for changes in the worm's epigenome, the chemical markers that tell the DNA in the cells how to behave. The epigenome can be altered by the environment and the changes passed from one generation to the next. Sabanaigam studies the epigenome in the context of microgravity.
When the worms are in a liquid environment, that some epigenomic marks persist even when we take the animal out of the liquid environment and put him back onto the normal ground conditions. So its offspring retains this epigenomic memory of the parent's liquid environment or microgravity environment.
The laboratory will continue the experiments. So far, the data suggests that the epigenomic marks passed on to future generations are acquired during embryo development. Sabanaigam says identifying that genetic marker is critical to human studies in the future.
Our work with the worms speeds up this process. It's a model organism, but we think that we can find human orthologs or similar genes that responded to microgravity in the worms. We think that we can find them in the human genome and possibly closely monitor those when astronauts go on a space station, travel to the moon, or potentially Mars.
Sabanaigam expects C. elegans to fly on the International Space Station within 2 years. He hopes in the long term the data can be used to develop simple, cheap, and quick tests to assess an astronaut's health. The work was presented this week at the annual meeting of the Biophysical Society in Baltimore, Maryland. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Let's see if you have the correct answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. From the following, what was the name of the first spacecraft to ever reach Jupiter? Was it A, Pioneer 10, B, Voyager 1, or C, Cassini? The answer is A. NASA's Pioneer 10 became the first spacecraft to reach the giant planet back in December of 1973. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World.
A group of planetary scientists wants to study Jupiter's atmosphere with a swarm of mini-cube satellites. The tiny mini-probes will all be self-contained and assigned to do only one specific task each. It's believed that scientists will be able to gather more diverse and more thorough information by using a bunch of tiny probes versus using one larger spacecraft. The science group is hoping to perhaps join their mini-probe mission with the European Space Agency's JUICE orbiter mission set to begin in 2030. John Moores of the Center for Research in the Earth and Space Sciences at Toronto's York University is a member of this scientific group and co-authored a paper outlining the proposed mission in a recent edition of International Journal Space Science and Engineering. Dr. Moores tells us about his group's plans and why an armada of tiny probes will provide more and better data on Jupiter's atmosphere than one large spacecraft. How many of these tiny satellites are you hoping to deploy?
Well, one of the great things about it, it's very modular. So you could do as few as 6, or you could do as many as 60 in a single launch.
How many are you planning in this particular project?
Well, we'd love to do the whole 60. That would give us the opportunity to visit 10 different spots on Jupiter.
Does this proposed endeavor have a name?
We call it SMARA. That name, by the way, stands for Small Reconnaissance of Atmospheres, but we also like it because the special thing about our probes is that they have a large surface area, so they fall gently through the Jovian atmosphere without requiring a parachute, just like the fruit of the maple tree falls gently through the atmosphere and covers a large distance.
Each of the little probes, I understand, will be assigned one task. What kind of jobs will they be assigned to do, gathering what kind of information?
Well, there's all sorts of things that we don't know about the Jovian atmosphere. For instance, we've only had one probe that's traveled into the atmosphere before. That was with a U.S. mission back in the 1990s called Galileo. And the Galileo probe, for instance, didn't have a camera. So we don't have an image from inside the atmosphere. At these small scales, we've also never looked at the clouds in different wavelengths of light to see what's going on, what drives the weather and the dynamics.
What kind of instruments, what kind of equipment will these little gadgets have?
Well, you could imagine a whole range of things, from cameras to spectrometers to look at these different wavelengths of light to instruments that would ingest a little bit of the gas and tell us what it's made of. And you could have other little instruments that would look at individual particles because we're hoping to pass through clouds.
What kind of information, Dr. Moores, do you and your colleagues hope to learn with this armada of mini probes?
Well, we still have yet to see the Jovian atmosphere at anything better than about 15 kilometers per pixel. So right now, the small-scale dynamics is completely unknown. That's where the images will help us out. Understanding what these clouds are made of will help us understand how these dynamics are run. So it really tells us an awful lot about the weather of a planet like Jupiter, which is all atmosphere and no surface.
I understand that the CUBE satellite technology is being used to circle the Earth. This is probably one of the first times that this technology will be used on a planet outside of Earth. What's the advantage of using the mini CUBE satellites versus like one large, more inclusive type of probe?
Well, it allows us to look at many different areas, and this is a technology that's really grown up in the last 10 or 20 years. Having 60 different probes means that it's okay if a couple of them don't work. And that lets you create these probes a lot more cheaply, and it lets you look at different parts of the atmosphere. With the last big probe that was sent, that Galileo probe, you had the issue that it ended up going through a very unusual part of the Jovian atmosphere. It wasn't like the rest of the planet. And if instead you're sending 60 different probes with these small CubeSats, then you get a much more representative picture of all the processes that are happening on a global scale.
Dr. Moores, the probes, I understand, will be solar-powered. Why solar power and not use any other form of energy?
Well, Jupiter is at the distance from the sun where you can just do solar power easily. Well, not easily, but it remains a possibility. So, for instance, the Juno probe, which is headed out to Jupiter, is using solar cells. The individual probes that go into the atmosphere will be deployed from a large carrier, and it's the carrier that has the solar panels. The individual probes themselves, they have batteries that get charged just before they're sent into the atmosphere.
I understand that the little probes will be sort of self-contained. They won't even have a parachute. So I'm guesstimating here that the probes will eventually burn up as they enter the atmosphere. How much time will you have to gather information, gather data?
Well, our calculations show that it's about 15 minutes that you get in the upper atmosphere. And then as the probes continue to sink, the atmosphere gets thicker and thicker and hotter, and eventually the probes melt away.
That was John Moores from the Center for Research in the Earth and Space Sciences at York University, Toronto, Canada. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.